Oh hey, I'm glad you're here. I said it before, but growing up in my dad's video store, I would endlessly peruse the fantastical box art. Movies like Deathstalker, Future Kill, Hello Mary Lou Prom Night 2, and Dr. Frankenstein's Castle of Freaks would freeze me in my tracks. Eventually, I would recognize faces, and that would lead me to search out films with the same actors, Mansion of the Doomed to The Visitor to Savage Dawn to Near Dark to Pumpkinhead, for instance. No, this episode isn't about Lance Henriksen, but where are my Henriksen heads at? Nina? JJ? Grace? No? After actors, I recognized production studios. New Line, Full Moon, Media, and Vestron were some faves. But the next big piece of the puzzle was when I finally put together the job of the director. The first one I ever started chasing the work of was David Cronenberg. I think it went The Fly to Scanners to Videodrome to The Brood. Whoa. Yeah. It's crazy. But what does a director even do? Most people have no idea. A lot even get it twisted. I heard so many people call The Protector a Quentin Tarantino film, because the release said Quentin Tarantino presents, but he didn't direct it. The same thing for the first Hostel film. What a pickle. As a kid, I think we see a director first in Looney Tunes cartoons, as a guy behind a curtain in culottes, sitting in a folding chair with a bullhorn shouting, "Action!" and then losing their temper. But we never speak with one. Career Day didn't have directors, at least not in my school. So where do they come from? Are they birds? Can they breed robots? How many times have they had a sleepover with Eric Estrada? All of this and more will not be covered in this episode, but we do address this director's new film, Scare Me, premiering on Shudder October 1st. But this film is The Pickle. The guest is a director, and this is VHS. Hello and welcome to VHS, the podcast where each episode is about a film and the guest has the profession portrayed in the film. I'm your host, Dirk Marshall. I'm joined in the studio by Josh Rubin, who is a director. Thank you for being here.
Pleasure.
People can find more about you on your website, joshesmindhouse.com, not joshrubin.com, which is just a picture of a boat.
Correct. I think he's in Nashville and we've never met.
Okay. The boat?
Yes. Yes, that's Josh.
And you're Josh Rubin on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.
Correct. Oh. I think I deactivated my Facebook, but if it's still active, you're welcome to send me a friend request.
Okay. As is sometimes the case, citing you as just a director is completely not true. You also write, act, and produce as well. And you were in Greener Grass. Is that true?
I was. My scene was cut devastatingly so, but it was one of the most fun experiences ever to fly down there, make the amount of money of the flight, and and play a swim coach to a dog, which was so fun. Oh, I've known those directors, writers, Jocelyn and Don forever.
Yeah, that movie is total insanity, and I absolutely adore it. But one role I wanted to ask you about is, what could you tell me about an ultraviolet bartender in One Life to Live?
That was my big break, you know? Back then I was like, whoa, you're not gonna fucking believe this. I got what's called an under five as ultraviolet bartender in One Life to Live. So it was a soap that probably still shoots.
Still going, yes.
I auditioned. I still remember the casting director's name. Her name was Tori Vigilio, and you found her name in Backstage or Ross Reports magazine. I submitted my picture, and I can't believe it, based on the headshot, and like, I don't even know what the audition was. Like, hi, watermelon martini? Okay, you know. I got the job, and it was like the most money I'd ever seen in my life, which I think was like $800, like every time I'd go or something, which was still cool. And I wore this jumpsuit, and I literally, they called me back like five times, but I'd only ever have like one line.
Yeah.
And it would move so quickly. And I always thought I did a bad job, but they, you know, they continued to have me back. And I'll never forget one time, it was the EP would always be around. He was like this tall, lanky, slick haired dude who McConaughey essentially played in Wolf of Wall Street. And I remember overhearing him say, I'm 5'7". I remember him overhearing him say, like, I'll never hire someone shorter than 5'10 on this show.
What?
As a recurring. That's like one of the things I take with me. But it was basically my first professional, like, television acting job.
That's awesome. What is an ultraviolet bartender?
Ultraviolet was the name of the bar.
Oh, I thought I thought you worked at a tanning salon or something, but
might as well have been. Yeah. And I had a mechanic suit, and it was, you know, violet colored.
Right.
Good times.
You're also on Cameo, I noticed. So if anyone's listening and they got fired from Burger King, they could hire Jeff Bridges to tell off their boss.
Yeah, flip a burger, man. We'll have a joint and
I love your Jeff Bridges so much. It's
oh my god,
it brings endless joy to me. I've re-listened to you on the You Made It Weird podcast probably 5 times. It's the only podcast I've listened to more than one time. Because it's just the silly times are so contagious.
It's so silly. It's so silly. Yeah. Those are good feels.
Yeah. Jeff Bridges talking about photography is.
Yeah. The camera strap.
Yeah.
Yeah. My sunburn.
But the reason we were joined by Josh today is because we're brought together by the film The Pickle from 1993. Was this a first time watch for you?
It was a first time watch, and I remember seeing the VHS cover for years and thinking someday. And in fact, probably flipping through like Cinemax Vanguard and seeing 4 seconds of it and being like, someday.
Someday.
First time caller, last time watcher.
Okay. the synopsis of the film is an unsuccessful director creates a melancholy mess while in New York to preview his science fiction schlocker, which is so smoothly written. Quite a synopsis. At the time of this recording, it's available on DVD exclusively, so you'll have to go to your local rental shop like Movie Madness here in Portland. So let's put the film in context. The director is Paul Mazursky. He did Bob and Carol, Ted and Alice in 69, Next Stop Greenwich Village, Moscow on the Hudson, Down and Out in Beverly Hills, Scenes from a Mall, but he was also an actor who was in Stars Born, Into the Night, Carlito's Way, and a musician bunny in Kung Fu Panda 2.
Fantastic career. Yep. He's like a he's like what Taika Waititi was, except more problematic.
The cinematographer is Fred Murphy. He did Heartland, Hoosiers, Night Game, Jack the Bear, Mothman Prophecies, Freddy versus Jason, and Drillbit Taylor.
Wow, I wonder if in Mothman Prophecies he argued with Mark Pellington, who was a music video director, and just like, please, more visual.
Yeah, he's like, wow, I did The Pickle.
Yeah.
The editor is Stuart Papp, I think, who edited What's Love Got to Do With It, Sister Act 2, Back in the Habit, Mr. Magoo, George in the Jungle, okay. American Pie 2, White Chicks, and Wild Hogs.
Dang.
Yeah.
Leslie Nielsen in your filmography, though. That's pretty cool.
And then we just have 3 stars. There's a lot of cast, but we're not going to take up all day with that. Danny Aiello, he's a legend. Godfather 2, The Stuff. Fort Apache, The Bronx. The Madonna Papa Don't Preach video. Everyone remembers that. And Do the Right Thing. Just some of his filmography, which I think is pretty astounding. Diane Cannon, Kangaroo Jack. I mean, come on.
I mean, unreal.
Caddyshack 2, Heaven Can Wait, Revenge of the Pink Panther. She's awesome. And the last one I wanted to mention was Chris Penn, because he unfortunately died so young. Footloose, Reservoir Dogs, True Romance, and Deceiver, which is an episode we did with a polygraph technician on this podcast.
Ooh, damn.
Yeah. But let's press play on The Pickle, which I think is how DJs refer to sex. The film starts with whimsy, both musical and font, and then we get instantly Danny Aiello and Jerry Stiller. I love these two. They're like a good combo.
A flying pickle? What have I done? A crime against humanity. I didn't direct the movie. I committed a crime. Why is this limo so hot? It's like a gas chamber in here.
You made a commercial movie, Harry.
I made toilet paper.
I think the kids will go for it.
Is it odd? I don't know if this is problematic. Is it odd that Jerry Stiller kind of resembles a chimp and was eating bananas the whole movie? Like, is there something like a chimp in a suit?
Oh my gosh.
That Mazursky was like, you know what's fun? Like, it was like Mazursky's little secret.
Yeah.
And he was like, you know, it would be funny if you had bananas, and Jerry just kind of went with it.
I don't think that that's crazy. I think you're probably really onto something there.
Yeah, I hope so.
In the opening scene, they already said the pickle twice. So if you're drinking for this movie, get ready.
I love the deluge of exposition. I mean, not to mention the money that you know, how much debt you're in your last 2 films. It duds.
and I went back to Hollywood and committed suicide. Why? Tell me why I did it, Phil.
$400,000 in back taxes, then there's the question of your two alimonies, plus the fact your last few films have not been hits, Harry.
How about three disasters in a row? Three huge bomberinos, the record.
But the pickle will be a hit. My nose tells me, and my nose is usually dependable.
There's so much. Danny's stressed about selling out. They banter in an elevator, and they run into a fan, and she lists off his accolades.
Oh, I love Paradise, Jack. I think the critics were all wrong.
Lady, we gotta go.
Oh, well, thank you, Mr. Stone, and good luck with the preview of The Pickle.
And she says The Pickle, so I think like every scene there's like a quota for pickle mentioning in case you forget what movie you're watching.
Drinking Game.
Yeah, phenomenal. She also says she loves his films but thinks the critics were wrong, so we get a backhanded compliment. For anyone not in the industry, is this something that you've encountered at all?
Oh, God. The only time I've ever encountered it was at College Humor, like, you know, 14-year-olds would be like, I love when you made the seagull noise. Like, not for, I love your film canon, maybe in 10 years.
Right.
I do admire the romanticism of, like, walking into the plaza and, you know, having some rando fawn over me. But I'm also, the more I realize what that actually is and the social ramifications of that or oddity of that, it just gives me anxiety.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, great, someone loved my old Western.
Right. That is such an interesting thing. Not a lot of people's professions have something like fandom involved. So how is it, I mean, you're now wearing multiple hats doing different things, but how do you navigate like day-to-day being Josh to when you're in a situation where you encounter people that are just like, I love this thing that you did. And then what are you supposed to do with that? Like,
that's a really good question, because let me preface by saying I used to love, as a chubby kid with two friends, the idea of being famous. Sure. Like, I can't wait to be, you know, whatever, chased and fawned over.
Yeah.
And now the idea gives me such anxiety, you know, coronavirus notwithstanding.
Sure.
I don't know. I love my life and privacy and, you know, the ability to, the old example, you know, would be like, you know, what, love to be able to walk around a mall and not have anyone come after me.
Right.
But now it's just like, the idea of not only the public space, but also, you know, being Instagram message bombed or whatever by randos. And in what very few circumstances I've had that were unusual, it was very few too many. When they're great, they're great.
Sure.
But what are you supposed to do with, you know, you're so awesome or I love all this stuff? You can only say thank you so much and be nice. I'm still weird about getting compliments. I don't know how to respond to them in an odd way.
Right.
So you just say thank you. But it's a very, very strange thing, especially the concept of people feeling an entitlement to knowing you or thinking that they know you.
Yeah.
Canon.
Well, it's like I said, I've listened to you so many times on a podcast. That alone is a weird thing. That I'm just like, I'm going to go listen to your voice. Like, it's just like, and then the more that you do that with anything, then you feel like, oh, well, if I see that person, I've got to say something. But it's like, do you?
Yeah.
I mean, they're clearly doing something else right now. It's not like you're at a show where you're like, anyone can come talk to me right now. You know, you're like eating a sorbet.
I can't imagine being like Finn Wolfhard, like the people that just feel like they know him. He'll never be able to go anywhere. You know, it was one thing to be Leo and only have like instant messenger if you find out his nickname is Stick Boy. But it's like, you know, to run up on some celebrity because they saw you in some movie. So, oh, you're just like me. Terrifying. You just say thank you. That's the short answer.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
It's weird. It's never going to be not weird.
Yeah. It's a weird byproduct of a profession. It's you know, foot doctors don't have that.
Yeah. But there's like some ancient Greek word for justifying your own existence. And I think that there's something about touching celebrity that scratches that itch. So it's like, if I'm validated by Brad Pitt, well, that means that, you know, life's worth living. I don't have to take a bunch of sleeping pills in my hotel room, leaving a message for lovers.
Not today, but.
Not today.
Yes. Next, they go meet in an office full of giant cacti. That's the plural. correct? I see, right behind you, there's a cactus. So that's
correct. One of my favorite comedic moments of the movie, maybe the only, one of two times I laughed out loud, was when his shoulder got pricked.
This is my dream come true.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I have to get those trimmed. Hello, Phil.
Hello, Ronnie.
Good to see you.
It was just a great detail. And then it pretty much went downhill from there.
Yes. Barry Miller is the guy there. He's, I guess, the producer. That's the producer role. Yeah. Yes. He was in The Last Temptation of Christ, Saturday Night Fever, Peggy Sue Got Married. Those are two different movies. He's amazing. The scene has five pickles.
Yes, it does.
That's right. I began counting pickles per scene because this movie... Barry presents a giant prop pickle and says the farmers will fly around in it, and he's the director's unsure, but promised a ton of money.
What's the pickle?
The pickle. Well, the pickle is a film idea that I have about a bunch of farm kids from Kansas, Idaho, you know, somewhere warm and grassy. Bunch of typical blonde-haired farm kids who are into growing these really, like, these super duper large cucumbers for the county fair. Well, all of a sudden, they discover that one of the cucumbers won't stop growing. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and whoosh.
One of the interesting things about your profession is that it's different from an optometrist who maybe gets paid an hourly wage. I actually don't know why I used optometrist because I don't know how they get paid, but you get paid by the gig or the job. And that can fluctuate wildly. Like, you've directed two features now, but you've also done sketches, shorts, commercials. So what's different for you directing those projects? Commercial to like sketches or a feature?
Well, sketches. So if you're talking about something like College Humor, I had a salary at College Humor. I was sort of, an on-staff cast member. So I might as well have also worked at Vimeo.
Got it.
And made, you know, whatever a year to do these 10 things. With, you know, the same company shit. You work for IAC, you're working for the man, you know. Mm-hmm. And being Barry Diller, not Barry Miller. And then with commercials, that's probably the best to a degree. Though you feel like you're selling your soul, and it's probably one of the most, I'll go on record as saying, usually the most miserable experiences, because you're selling your soul for, like, you know, a toilet paper brand.
Right.
But the best part is you're in and out in 2 weeks. And you can kiss ass in and out in 2 weeks. And what I enjoy about it is when it's good, then, and you're in and out in 2 weeks, and you make enough money to kind of live for a stretch, it's great. It's worse when you don't know what the next gig is going to be, when you don't know, you know, when you can't even find a toilet paper brand to sell your soul to. That's a scary thing. And the movies, you know, the first one, I lost money on it. I took money out of my 401k to make the movie happen, along with some connections I have in the industry that were willing to take a small chance on me financially. And because the movie costs so little, the idea is, because it's a genre film, hopefully we'll soon get in the black when the picture drops.
Right. Which is called Scare Me, right?
Scare Me. Yeah, exactly. And that's a tiny indie. And then, you know, my last film, Werewolves Within, is, you know, 6.5-7 times the budget, you know, because there is a budget. And that's the best version of, you know, life thus far. I got to, as the director, opt or vote my hometown to go shoot in. We shot in upstate New York. I made DGA. Granted, it's technically an independent film, but you make a certain tier salary, which is great. They pay you in installments, and the job sort of goes on and on. So, you know, it's been great given the pandemic, because I'm doing post at home.
Right.
Job essentially began, I think my contract kicked in December to start rewrites, and is finishing in August. So you have a job for, you know, 6 months essentially. And then the funny thing is you look at the money they give you and you're just like, okay, cool. So I understand Danny, Harry Stone's situation. You're just kind of like, okay, so that's going to run out, but you know, you just kind of budget yourself. So you understand when some of these guys, some of these actors, some of these directors, even Scorsese's been known to do it. I mean, everyone in the industry, they will eventually, you hear about how they take a money gig. Mm-hmm. So it was very relatable to hear him go, when do we start? I haven't had to do that yet. I've done it with commercials, but I'm sure when I'm 60 and wearing a big scarf, I'm going to be like, okay, the pickle reboot, you know, happy to do it.
Would you star in it as well?
All right, see, that would scratch the itch. makes it somewhat bearable. Yeah.
Does
Jason Batemaning it? Yeah.
When you're directing, does Robin Williams ever make an appearance on set?
I think because I've watched and absorbed so much of him as a kid, from like The World According to Garp, way too young, to Moscow on the Hudson and Patch Adams. He's a part of who I am, I think, just in how I talk and in my arm hair. I think it's just kind of what it is. So I think he does inadvertently. The energy's there and in my inflection. You can actually be so influenced by shit that you watch. It can be so formative that it becomes a part of your DNA. So I think he does.
Yeah.
Alberto, how's the light?
The light is bad.
Alberto, I got a mountain of work ahead of me. We're going to shoot it anyway.
The pickle is juicy. When she
what?
The pickle is juicy. When she hits the ground, she don't look like a pickle juice. She look like a green water.
Billy, you hear that? I need thicker pickle juice.
The next day they're shooting on set, and there's an argument about the thickness of the pickle juice. This was one of my favorite moments. He gets sprayed with the pickle juice, and a younger Don Trump appears.
Who gave them permission to shoot in front of the plaza?
Because just like in Home Alone 2, if you shoot on the property, he gets a part in the movie.
I didn't know he had anything to do with the plaza. He does? I guess it makes sense.
I guess. Well, they're shooting somewhere on there because that's how he got in the film. Same thing with Home Alone 2.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
You know,
but
he's very professional.
So gross. The guys talk about the premiere. The fan enters the room and demands sex with him, which is disturbing.
You excite people like me well. Now I'm going to live one of my fantasies. I'm going to have sex with one of the greatest directors of all time.
His ex-wife calls and he meets her for lunch. There's Diane Cannon. They recap their relationship and we get one pickle in the scene. So we get that.
That was one of 96 times giant Danny Aiello is seduced by or tried to seduce a beautiful woman.
So weird.
Including the suicide scene, which I'm sure we'll address.
Oh my gosh, we're going to get to that for sure. Just when you're trying to enjoy something, they're like, how about this sequence? I think my wife was really excited about that. Mm-hmm. On the way to the premiere, Francois shows up, and this is another problematic part of the film.
What the hell are you doing here, Francois?
I'm going to be with you for the preview. You need me to take care of you, not to mention my buddy.
She's so young.
She's 14.
14?
No, she's 22.
Oh, right.
That she's 22.
Oh my
then
gosh.
Yeah, we're slowly making our way towards a scene where she sits in his lap and he scoops ice cream into her mouth in front of a reporter. He has racist vibes to her.
Yes. So this scene has three pickles. Francois comes on to Harry in the limo and he says, I never have sex in a limo on the way to see my mother.
And then they both laugh and she says, show me the pickle.
Yes.
Show me the pickle.
She says it three times.
Show me the pickle.
Yeah, come on, Harry, show me the pickle.
We also get to see part of the film within a film. And I love movies that have films within films because it's just an excuse for anything to happen. It's like when someone turns a TV on in an improv scene, you're like, oh, great, cool. Someone's going to be a giraffe or whatever. In the sequence we see, there's a giant pickle and it has a ribbon on it. And I was like, wait, they had a giant spaceship pickle contest and it won, and who made this ribbon? Because the ribbon is fucking gigantic.
It's a lot of fabric, even for a farm town.
Yes. A lot of fabric for a farm town. In the barn we see a giant pickle spaceship. It prepares to lift off and Ally Sheedy is there.
Ready, Clem?
Ready, Molly girl.
Ready, Molly girl.
All right, let's get this pickle off the ground.
course.
Playing Molly, which is weird because like Molly Ringwald, Ally Sheedy, it's kind of a duo. It's like, yeah. I guess she wasn't available. The pickle launches in the softest way possible, and they're stoned laughing at it. Some of my favorite movies within movies, and you can let me know if you've seen them. Bowfinger has fake purse ninjas.
Wow, yeah.
Home Alone has angels with filthy souls. The Last Action Hero has Hamlet, where Arnold plays
Hamlet. So many good ones.
And Strange Brew, Mutants of 2051 AD. I watched
that. Tropic Thunder, too. You know.
Oh, yeah.
Forget like Slow Harry or whatever that Lawnmower Man comp was that they...
Oh, my gosh.
Dennis Miller was playing that, in the corduroy.
There's a lot in that movie.
Yeah. Oh, there's a lot to unpack.
I'm not sure how it's aging, but... Harry looks out the window and remembers being a kid, and it flashes back to his grandpa's soda fountain. Harry visits his mom, played by Shelley Winters, from Pete's Dragon, Cleopatra Jones, and The Purple People Eater. If you ever want to watch a movie that's totally insane, Purple People Eater is, it's really, it's crazy. It's got one eye, one horn, it's purple, it's a person in a suit, and it's something you'll never forget.
It's a feature. It's a feature
like 1988. Yeah, there's actors in it, like where you look at the names and you're like, "What?" You know, we covered it. It's a paycheck, I guess.
Yeah, paycheck. They were doing a lot more interesting drugs too back then.
In '88,
Dudley Moore was like, "Why not?"
Yes, he confesses that he sold out.
I'm scared.
Join the crowd. You take a number. You stand on a line.
You're afraid of dying. I'm afraid.
We flash back to the parents fighting with him in the middle on a Ferris wheel, and he tells a joke to defuse the situation. We sort of see Harry's beginnings in this moment, but what we don't know is about yours, Josh. When did you start, and when did that lean into directing? So when did you start acting, I guess, initially, and impressions and things, and then when did that take off to broaden?
Always mimicking, always trying to make the family laugh. My brother and my sister are 9 years older than I, and you know, they'd watch all the great horror and just sort of fun 80s movies, everything from Friday the 13th to Disorderlies.
Oh, yes.
You know, like random comedy and fun 80s horror.
Wait, did you, far too young. Because you are a mimic and have an ear, were you doing Fat Boys impersonations back in the
day? Oh, yes, absolutely, which also doesn't age well. But and all the way up through, you know, junior high, like quoting Spikorama.
Oh,
probably
right.
Also problematic. Like, but Robin Williams and John Leguizamo, like, was loving the fact that these guys could do the EGOT thing.
Yeah.
Or close to it. And then, you know, be comedians and dramatic actors. So rather than going to college, because I got a 950 on my SATs, my parents were like, well, you're pretty good. You're good in these local Woodstock youth theater productions. Why don't you try to get into a theater program in the city rather than going to college and, you know, doing more math. I got into the New Actors Workshop, which is an acting school co-founded by Mike Nichols. So
what?
Mike Nichols would come in once a week. If he wasn't shooting, at the time he was shooting Angels in America. So the first year kids got sort of, there's a first year and a second year. And if you're a second year student, you get to do scenes for Mike. And if you're a first year student, you would just observe. So I had 2 years, save for the conflict when he was shooting Angels in America and he was out, to watch him watch scenes. And there's the room is 30 people big.
Oh,
I mean,
gosh.
We're in an intimate room. And you'd watch him watch these kids do scenes from, like, you know, Spike Heel or Jeffrey or some play. And then he would give them feedback for an hour. So there was a 3 hour class. They do three scenes, and he'd give feedback for, you know, 45 minutes or so.
So is he taking notes?
So, He's just observing. Sometimes if the scene was so bad, he'd fall asleep. but he would always make you feel, you know, he would say, you know, the acting problem you have here reminds me of, you know, Meryl and Jack having had the same problem on Heartburn. So he was like a 20-year-old or an 18-year-old, which I was at the time, would be like, you just compared these guys to or us to or blah, blah, blah. So anyway, long story longer, shortly after New Actors Workshop. I graduate, do a little extra work, do some work for Best Buy, you know, try and survive in the city. And then some friends and I decide to form a sketch group called Dutch West. And we make sketches for the internet, the early iteration of the internet,
yeah. Like
before Flash and before YouTube, just uploading quick times to our, you know, URL and HTML website. And then that gets the attention of College Humor. College Humor says, come do for us what you've been doing, you know, independently and make sketches for us. And that turns into a 7-year job.
Wow.
That I was very resistant to, where I essentially was like, I thought it was going to be a desk job, but what it turned out to be was you get to come cut your teeth doing thousands of sketches in different genres, eventually getting into branded sketches, which happened 6 years after I joined of a 7-year career. Wow. And then because we started doing branded commercials, I ended up directing commercials, taking me out of College Humor into the freelance world. And why I ended up doing my first feature was because I got sick and tired of writing and passing shit out. I'm just sort of going like, when is someone going to give me a chunk of money to go make my own thing? Oh, I got to read Like Brothers, you know, by Mark Duplass and Jay, and just, you know, get inspired to make my own thing. And that was when things started to kick off in this new echelon was, hey, you gotta, you know, kick your own ass into gear, which is what my advice to any filmmaker who reaches out to me, like, how did you get where you are? It's like, bust your ass,
yeah.
You know, bust ass and invest in yourself, you know? So that's how I got here.
That's awesome.
Yeah. No Trumpian dad.
No. No.
No one gave me $1 million loan.
Hey, yo, what movie are you doing now?
I just finished a picture called A Pickle.
What's this pickle about?
Harry goes to a rougher looking neighborhood. He chats with people about the pickle, and we see the pickle fly through the air, and then we're back in the movie for more pickles. There's some racial slurs in the next scene, so we'll skip that. Back in his room, Harry and Francois have a food fight, which bleeds into an interview in a scene that is so crazy.
Oh my God, it's so fucking wild. He's eating a salami sandwich, spoon-feeding a 14-year-old French girl ice cream while doing an interview with a woman he's so pleasant to, yet just before was so racist, or like just had immediate racism towards Japanese people. And it was so normal. And I can't remember if this is before or after he fantasizes about doing Cortez and Montezuma with two white people.
I think
with Justin Hoffman and Warren Beatty.
I think we're coming up to that.
Yeah. I mean, it was so bizarre just watching a movie this age in today's climate.
Yeah.
Was just like, oh, okay. You don't realize when you're a kid watching movie after movie in this kind of climate. But then you watch these pictures and you realize why shit's problematic.
Yeah.
We grew up watching this stuff and just being like, this is normal.
Have you ever seen Dudes with John Cryer and Daniel Roebuck?
No.
Okay. It was one of my favorite movies growing up. It's like they're punk rockers. They go from from New York to LA in the desert. Somebody kills Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, who's one of their friends.
Of course.
And then John Cryer becomes embodied by the spirit of a cowboy, and Daniel Roebuck, a Native American.
Uh-huh.
Watched it a ton when I was a kid. It's amazing. Love the movie. Watched it in the theater with the director Penelope Spheeris. You felt the air sucked out of that theater the second Daniel Roebuck speaks in the voice.
Ooh, baby.
Yeah, it is uncomfortable. And I was sitting there just like, no, I've seen this hundreds of times. How did I not? I mean, you didn't know then and what you know now. And it's just like, man.
You realize, well, I think about it a lot. I mean, not to get too tangential, but, you know, the climate of comedy back then, even in the early 2000s, and certainly when I started doing College Humor videos, if you look deep enough, you'll find plenty of problematic stuff that I did, my buddies did. I mean, we were all in high school telling those jokes.
Yeah.
You know what those jokes are, and thinking that it was perfectly fine and good.
Yeah.
And you realize like, oh yeah, like just like our grandparents would drop terrible language about certain, you know, certain ethnicities and certain, you know, minority groups.
Yeah.
marginalized people, you know, and then that, how that carries on generationally, that you think in high school it's cool to make jokes about different ethnicities and different minorities, and then you look back even 5 years ago,
remember, like,
gay jokes were everything and saying things are gay. Even Friends, you know, you look back and watch episodes of it. So it's really fascinating to look back and go like, oh yeah, no, and through this new lens, we've got some fucking work. You know, it's fascinating.
Yeah, anyway. I mean, mainstream films and stuff, you know, where just a couple years ago, and I'll watch them and just be like, oh wow, this is highly homophobic, and this is like a major motion picture.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, even last night we were watching the new Eurovision movie, the Will Ferrell movie, which is a perfect blend of like silly sweet for today. And, you know, Rachel McAdams is asking Dan Stevens if he's gay. And even that, even though they throw around, you know, these like woke terms like non-binary, it's still odd. It's still like it shouldn't matter. It's still like, why was this in the film? Anyway.
Because it's funny. We put it in there.
Yeah, right.
And you're like, well.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
See what you're doing there. But yes, the scene is weird, uncomfortable, and there's two more pickles. I'll tell you what's not weird and uncomfortable, our sponsor, and we'll be right back.
Are you tired of boring food and condiments being made of pre-processed ingredients? Then you need Marshall's Hot Sauce. Eat small batches made by Sarah Marshall, dude, who sources from local farmers. Her dedication to knowing the sources carries on through right down to knowing the single-origin beekeeper and even the harvester of sea salt. Each sauce is plant-based, gluten-free, and packed with deliciousness. I'm not kidding, children. With an annual offering of mild and spicy sauces like smoked habanero BBQ, red chili lime, serrano ginger lemongrass, and habanero carrot curry, she is not effing around, children. Plus a rotating offering of limited edition sauces like whiskey smoke ghosts, cartilage scorpion ghosts, the volcano sparkle, and even a collaboration with the heatonist, Bird's Eye Charred Chive Dolls. There's always something new and delicious being offered. Head on over to Marshall's Hot Sauce and checking out, enter VHUS in the promo code for 20% off. Sheesh. That's VHUS at checkout for 20% off. And now back to the show.
And we're back. And in case you're just tuning in, please write us and explain how that happened, as this is a podcast. But nonetheless, I'm here with Josh Rubin, a pickle expert. Josh, could you tell us your top five pickle facts?
Oh, God. One is promoted by a bird.
Yep.
The other ones you can stack.
Yes.
There are ones you can stack.
True.
Jews love them. Not all of them are sour, and some of them are sweet. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
That's correct. Perfect. And this brings us to the part where we play a game. Josh, is this a pickle type or something Dirk made up?
Ooh.
There's five options. Number one, Kool-Aid.
Oh, that's a real thing.
Okay, you're correct. Gherkin.
A real thing.
Okay. Paul Blart Pickle Cop.
Made up.
Okay. Bread and butter.
Real.
Yep. And Chris Pickle Pen.
Ooh, that sounds totally factual.
Yeah.
I'm just, that's not
You're
real.
You're five for five. Good job. And that's when Chris Penn enters the movie.
You must be the publicist. You look worried.
I assure you I'm fine. Or is it the pickle you're worried about?
And he drops two pickles.
Hey, Dad.
Oh, that's, hey, Dad. That's a really good
Chris. I guess I can do a Chris. I mean, I can't, you know, you can't take it public, but... That's basically Chris.
Have you ever tried Chris Penn before?
No, this is the first time. This is a Chris Penn exclusive.
Wow, you nailed it with a pickle Chris Penn.
You want to go buy a heart monitor?
I like it because he sounds like he needs the heart monitor.
I mean, it's just, you want to go electronic store. Ah, Dad.
How much of when you are listening to someone's voice is the breath?
Oh, 70%. It's all Guillermo del Toro is, and it was certainly a lot of Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yes.
You know, I think actually Phil Hoffman, De Niro, and Guillermo have the same deviated septum kind of, you know, that purr breath.
And they're just slightly different octaves, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I don't do any impressions, but at this part of the film, he talks with his dad, and it involves a talking cat. He's talking about a movie he wants to make with a talking cat.
Over my dead body, I'll never make a movie about a talking cat.
You just made a movie about a flying pickle.
No one is going to buy a script about a talking cat.
And, I don't do impressions, but I do a character who does impressions, and I'll run it by you. And anyone can do this. His name's Clitsworth Wobblepots, and he can impersonate celebrities, but only by saying the name of other celebrities, so he's very confusing. So it goes like this. Okay, here's my impression of Sean Connery. Master P. That's the... So people are confused on why Sean Connery is saying Master P. Yeah, so... So that's my, that's the whole character.
League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
he's saying the worst movie he was in.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. He doesn't go Zardoz, he goes with a League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
What about this one? Steve Norrington. Wow, I can't believe I knew that. What's Steve Norrington? Nah, whatever.
Oh, man. They go to a place with portable blood pressure machines. The guy said he sold one to Woody Allen, and Danny Aiello wants to know Woody Allen's blood pressure.
So Mazursky. That's what they call pulling a Mazursky.
Yes. Yeah. There's so many parts in this where I was like, this is the dialogue that's happening in this movie? Like,
they don't make them like they used to.
No, that's true. There's only one pickle.
This is what they call it.
They head to a nightclub and run into one of Harry's exes, and Chris Penn says all of his mothers are talented.
Just leans further into the... Oh, and also, not too long after he was so racist to the Japanese woman, do we find out that one of his former wives, I think, was Chinese.
Yes.
And also, she's like 25.
Yeah, yeah. Diane Cannon is like an appropriate age, but everybody else is like... It's very questionable.
Autumn in New York. It spells the thrill of first nighting.
Harry starts singing along, much to the sadness of the audience in a club, and they remove him. He sees a shrink, and he wants to show her his pickle. The scene has five more pickles. I don't even know what that I wrote there.
I hope you did a final pickle tally.
I'm going to. For sure. He can't breathe. She calls the hospital. He needs water and flashes back to his childhood again. And it's kids insulting each other in a synagogue.
I didn't understand why we went back.
Every time we went back, I was like, what?
Yeah, a new texture. Like, he could have cut out 30 minutes.
Yes.
For sure.
Yeah, it's a long pickle.
You kind of get it. I would have kept the carousel scene. It's like, oh, you brought your parents together with stories.
Right.
Or the goosebumps scene. Hey. Okay. Yeah,
that brings something. I didn't know what I was supposed to get from the soda pop fountain scene.
Correct. Same.
Spalding Gray shows up as the Dr. Spalding, proving this movie can do whatever it wants.
Absolutely. Hi, I'm Doc. All I heard was Spalding. I heard, hi, I'm Spalding.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. He was actually kind of great, and I couldn't place if he was the dad in Panic Room or not. And then I realized, no, he's... I was like, oh, he's disappeared.
Yeah, he's Spalding Gray. In my dad's video store I grew up in, there was Spalding Gray. I think it was called The Box. And and that cover, I stared at forever until I eventually was like, I'm going to watch this. And then I was like, what is this? Who is this person?
For some reason, it was always on.
Yeah.
Like, was that the one? Weren't they all two of them or whatever? Weren't they always just him in front of
a
black space?
Yes.
Smoking cigarettes?
I have no idea.
It was always around. Like, I kind of want just a screen printed, you know, a black T-shirt with a screen printed Spalding Gray shirt, and just say, I just didn't know what this was. I'm just like, it's just an image of my childhood.
Yeah, you know? It's Spalding Gray. I mean, you guys know, and just watch people be like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. You remember this image from your childhood?
Oh man. So she puts him to bed, and from his coat, she takes the video out. I think this is the 14-year-old. And she puts it in to finish the movie.
We discovered the harmfulness of red meat, sir. So, Mr. President, we became vegetarians.
We've brought you samples of every vegetable known to man on Earth so you can plant them in your fields and you can save Cleveland.
Please excuse our president's laughter. It's hardly your fault that your information is so outdated.
But if you scratch a Clevelandian, you're going to get this kind of bottom line honesty.
Point is, Molly girl, that we only eat meat on Cleveland.
And we see President Little Richard, which I would accept. I love President Little Richard.
You think they had to pay for the rights for Good Golly Miss Molly? Like, do you think they could have saved, like, they could have not saved $45,000?
I think
they had to do that.
I think he agreed to do it so they'd use the song. I think yeah. probably is what happened. Griffin Dunne appears in the movie, and I'm like, what is the casting? So my question for you is, when you're directing, say, the two features, how involved are you in casting?
It's everything. Every inch of it, especially being an actor as well. So it's like one of the things I feel like I know and have sort of onus over. Yeah. I don't ever leave anything to a caster. Yeah, find a good bodega owner mm-hmm. type. It's everything. It's everything. And especially with this last film, it was a lot of me going to not only who am I a fan of that I can go to, but who are some buddies, because I'm still relatively unknown at a certain tier to a certain tier of actors. So you send the first movie around to some of them to see if they kind of like this stranger's work.
Yeah.
A, but B, I went directly to, you know, people like George Basil, and I would say, hey, you're playing opposite this other character who's your partner,
yeah.
who's your girlfriend, yeah. the entirety of the movie. Who do you like? Who do you want to go to? Who might be enticing?
Oh, that's interesting.
To you to bring aboard. So I had actors tell me or give me a few options.
Yeah.
Who you like? Who would you like to go to? Harvey Guillen said, "I what about Cheyenne Jackson?" And I was like, oh my God, I fucking love Cheyenne. And I never would have thought of Cheyenne Jackson.
Yeah.
The casting hadn't necessarily, as immediately, they probably eventually would, to play his partner. So we went to Cheyenne Jackson. We went to Sarah because George was like, what about Sarah? So it's a way to kind of, you know, it was a way to help build out the ensemble and also give our actors an immediate chemistry.
Yeah.
There's an immediate friendship. We're going to the middle of nowhere. You at least get a buddy to bring with you to Fleischman's New York and have to get coffee with when we're not shooting.
Yeah.
To look around on set and go like, oh, you're my bud. So anyway, long story longer again, you know, casting's crucial.
Yeah. Well,
I would never cast Isabella Rossellini and have her not say anything.
Oh my God. Happen. When she shows up on the screen, I just turned to my wife and I was like, Isabella Rossellini's in this? Because she's not credited.
Is she an extra?
She's not credited. Yeah. Neither is Dudley Moore.
Well, they're credited in the credits within the movie.
Oh, yes. But not, it's like, if you go to IMDb, Dudley Moore is like at the very bottom uncredited, as is Griffin Dunne. I don't know if that was by request, but Isabella Rossellini, nowhere to be found.
I think they were all like, sure, I'll walk up to the plaza and get pickle juice sprayed on me.
Right.
I mean, like, for anybody who was like in and around New York, like, sure, I'll go fuck around with this strange ass movie.
Who's the president? Little Richard. All right, yeah, I'll be in it. Little Richard says everyone on the planet dies at 49 and he's 48.
But that's terrible.
How old do you think I am?
Well, you look very good, sir.
48 and a half.
Then you'll be dead in 6 months.
Molly girl, don't be sad. Be glad. Don't be mad and feel like you've been had. Good golly, Miss Molly.
And then they burst into Good Golly, Miss Molly for a duration. It's my favorite part, probably. My wife and I were losing it at that point.
It goes on for 26 seconds too long, and every time Griffin and Allie kiss,
yeah.
and they're talking about like how they only eat meat,
yeah.
it was like, imagine how the kiss smells. I don't know, it was just a weird combo. They had good chemistry, though, I guess. So.
Yeah. Harry's heading to see his ex-wife, and the door guy picks up, and he expects the doorman to ask him about the pickle, because everybody has, and this scene is...
Thank God for New York doorman.
This scene's so brief, and it still has three pickles.
Aren't you going to wish me luck with the pickle?
The pickle? What's the pickle?
Harry's heading into his ex. The door guy calls up. Oh, wait, I just said the part. Harry says he wants to meet her again. He's aggressive. She says no. He climbs out a window in the scene that we mentioned before, which is highly problematic.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yes, it absolutely is.
It's really horrific. And it's unfortunate that then Diane Cannon decides to get back together with.
Oh my God. He throws a temper tantrum that they won't get married, threatens suicide. He comes back inside. And when they start to get close, I'm thinking, okay, well, there's a runner in here where he gets close to kissing her, but they don't. Yes. So surely she's going to knee him in the balls.
Yeah, because she seems like a not strong only character.
Not only does she get down on the ground and say how much she like loves his lips, but that this is a mercy fuck. That's about as strong as she gets. Yeah. And I'm just like, oh my goodness, how problematic.
It's really not great.
Smile. Yeah.
We then get a scene where the boys are having a meal, and Stephen Tobolowsky shows up in the movie. People know him from Single White Female Spaceballs. That's two different movies. He's Ned from Groundhog Day. Everyone knows that one. In this scene, he's on a diet and he orders just a plain potato.
Do you have a nice potato?
Certainly, sir. Baked, boiled, fried?
Baked. Baked. No butter, no sour cream.
Some margarine?
No. Just the potato.
Hey, Mike, why are you trying to lose weight?
I just got a new valve put in.
A hot valve? No, they put a valve up his ass. Don't they do valve jobs in France, Harry?
That was probably one of the funniest sort of beats or runners. Okay, Stephen Tobolowsky asking for in my potato. Yeah. Constantly.
When you say runner, what are you referring to?
I'm referring to the continuous bit. So it recurs, and likely in the most successful version of it in comedy are either threes or fives.
Okay.
So it's like, he'll ask for it three times, and then the third time's like the most heightened, or five times being the most heightened. There's something about that comedy math, and that was my favorite runner. It's like he mentions it,
yes,
two exchanges, yep, three exchanges, he mentions it again but in a different way,
yeah,
and then on the third time he says, "Ben, seriously, the potato."
Yes. It's even in movies like The Pickle, which is probably not anyone's favorite movie, but you will always find these scenes. Because like growing up in a video store, people that remember VHS, you would watch the duration of a film. You wouldn't turn it off 2 minutes into it. And oftentimes, the third act, you would see something crazy that you didn't know was going to happen that you wouldn't have seen now. Because we have Netflix where we're like, is it good? It's not good. Is it good? It's not good. I don't like this. I hate this. One star. But like back then, you just watched things. And I missed that, because this potato scene is a very fun moment. It reminds me of indie cinema. It reminds me of time in movies where I didn't know who the actors were necessarily all the time. So that's my pointless speech about that. But I just
I had the same, a similar kind of thought. There's something sort of oddly cozy about these kinds of movies. I think there was a movie called, oh my God, I can't remember it. It was either Game 6 or Game 8, maybe, and it's Michael Keaton. And I might be missing two words, but it's literally him as like a sports agent or a scout. And he's walking around New York and he ducks into a restaurant because there's like a weird sewage, sewage drainage overflow. And it's causing this like noxious gas to like pour out from the West Village. And he's just like, the movie's just about him like trying to get to like have dinner with his daughter, but this like thing is delaying, something like that. But and it just feels like an, like oddly like a 1990s blanket. Like it just feels like there's just a lot of, light colored Levi's jeans and blazers with button ups.
Yes.
And a lot of New York like stereotypes, but the dialogue is just kind of like freewheeling. Uh-huh. About nothing in particular. And I felt that way about his walk with Shelley Winters. There was something about, I was like, oh, she's not just playing such a stereotypical or archetypal, nutty mom character. Like even like in The Sopranos, you'd think that there'd be some texture to her, I guess, eventually.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm just making that reference because I just started watching it. But that scene in particular was like, oh, that's a very natural, mm-hmm, real relationship, and I miss that.
Yeah.
And of course it's flanked and bookended by these like very problematic litter throughout the film, but anyway,
yeah, it's very true. In this scene they also mention polling audiences in a mall. What's your take on people asking random strangers about your film?
We did feedback seat screenings for Werewolves Within, but over Zoom.
Oh.
And tried to pull people who we were removed from who aren't in the industry. So what it used to be, I remember going to the mall.
Yes.
Or going to even movie theaters, and there would be sort of pollers there who would ask you if you were in the industry. And I would often say I was an actor or something, which would disqualify me. And sometimes lie and say I was like a still life photographer so that I could go and see, you know, whatever, the first Fast and Furious. So I think it's important. It's important to pull folks who have nothing to do with it so that you get like truly the furthest removed reaction to the film. And that's always fascinating to see, especially when they don't understand the concept of temporary special effects or that sort of thing. Sure. It's important. It's important to see what, like, you know, XYZ, you know, PTA member is going to think of, you know, this new movie. But it seemed to be a lot of swear words.
But if you get feedback like that, or I don't like werewolves, do you just discard that information, or are you like, maybe we need less werewolves?
If you're lucky enough to have a fairly woke executive or set of producers, which I absolutely do, they're wonderful. They're like, I mean, come on, you know, a comment like that. They don't like werewolves, but it's werewolf movie, too bad. But in some cases, there are some comments that XYZ mom, dad, or grandpa could make that isn't necessarily the proper demo for the movie that would get under the skin of someone who might have some influence on the final cut to go, well, X, Y, or Z mom, dad, or grandpa in the Midwest said that, you know, they like werewolves, but they don't like, you know, loud howl sounds. So maybe we got to take all the howl sounds out. But it's just one. So it's an interesting, you know, feedback screenings. Any writer or director, I think Mike Flanagan even recently wrote about it. It's the most convoluted, cockeyed, you know, means of getting feedback. And you ultimately just got to like it in your core group and get a little bit of feedback and move on.
Is it difficult to not be too precious with something that you've written, acted, and starred in? I mean,
oh, hell yeah. Yeah. I have such a hard time taking criticism, but every time I take all of it. I'm extremely collaborative, but I'm also, you know, not an only child, but the youngest.
Yeah.
So everything's got to be my way. And even if you're resistant to something, I don't entirely feel like works, you know, deep down.
Yeah.
I want my idea to work. And every time I've taken a note, or 99.9% of the time, it's a better movie because of it. Because you can also take it and foray it into the film and put your kind of spin on it. Like, I like the idea of that here. What about if we turn it back on its head?
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Pitch the update of Cortez and Montezuma that we talked about earlier.
Of course. Two white men.
Do you pitch ideas, or do you just create, like, you know, these two features, you wrote them? So
I didn't write werewolves. I did a rewrite. I did a revision. The original writer is Mishna Wolf.
Okay.
Yeah. Based on the she took it, created an original idea based on the video game, but Scare Me, I wrote that.
Yeah. So you don't take that to, I mean, do you have to do like what's called an elevator pitch, is what we hear from the outside of the—
Certainly for Scare Me and for other projects that I'm pitching or starting to pitch on, definitely.
Yeah.
There's a couple projects that I'm pitching on based on pre-existing stuff. What's your take on this thing that exists and that everybody loves, but what's a totally different version of it? And then there's, do you have any ideas in this world? And so, yes, depending on if it's a TV show or a film, you have to have— most movie folks are like okay with two sentences,
okay,
you know, and a comp. And if they want to take you seriously, really, they just want to read something. So it's like, if you have two compelling sentences, you're, you know, your compelling log line,
yeah,
send them something. And then for, you know, for a TV pitch, it gets a little more involved for sure.
Yes, she.
Oh, are you?
How are you? Oh, I can't complain. I know how you are. You're doing great all these years. Would you recognize me?
I don't know. You look pretty good.
Harry recognizes the guy running the projector because we need more flashbacks in the movie.
Butch! I couldn't place if he was the kid that he like got into an altercation with outside the synagogue.
I think that's what was happening. He remembers listening to opera and being moved by the music, and he gets goosebumps. And his mom says, never forget what it's like, what a human can make you feel. Which, even in a movie like The Pickle, I was like, that's kind of a beautiful thing, because you do probably get lost in your job. There's a lot of business, there's money, there's all kinds of things moving around, lots of different hats to wear, I'm sure. But in the end, something that you do can really sort of adjust someone's day, can make them feel really wonderful and bring a lot of joy into their life. But also
Huckleberry Finn.
But also it's very weird for someone to come up to you and tell you that. So
yeah that's why it's really important to ultimately take all the notes and just sort of go like, okay, how can I most objectively make this something that I would want to see,
right?
My buddy would want.
Yeah,
to see.
I'm very excited to see Scare Me, so I can't wait. For when is that coming out?
October 1st is the rumor, but we'll get the official word soon on Shudder. And then we're still sort of in today's era, sort of figuring out what the, if there'd be a drive-in situation, if there's some kind of digital situation in advance of Shudder that's, you know, feels like a movie theater release before it officially drops. But Shudder October 1 sounds like the official unofficial.
Awesome. That's a great month for it to come out on Shudder for sure.
Oh yeah.
Harry picks up pills from the pharmacy, and she congrats him on the pickle. A young girl shows up, brings her to his room. Everyone's wishing him the premiere is going to be great. There's a pickle cake. There's two more pickles in the scene. Moving right along, they all go to the preview except him. Now, you've acted and starred in Scare Me, which is we just touched on. How are you with watching yourself?
Pretty terrible. It's a loaded question because if it's heightened or if I play a character or caricature, I usually have no problem.
Yeah.
I don't watch and rewatch stuff. Some sketches I will if it's short form. So the movie I had to overcome, you know, Scare Me, I had to overcome any kind of issues. Like, okay, you gotta make this thing decent.
Yeah.
So I sort of made an effort to play someone based on certain people that I know. And that helped get over it, but it's usually hard.
Yeah, that makes sense. I showed my wife last night some of the Britishes from YouTube.
Oh wow, yeah.
Oh my gosh, the revenge episode. How much fun was shooting that? Because it's basically just you doing all of these different characters.
That was the most fun. That was probably one of the most fun experiences. There's been a recurring, there are these recurring kind of anchor points in my life, in my career with Sam Reich, who's an old dear friend who I met ages ago. And he and I essentially started making videos that became Dutch West, and that sort of initiative, what, you know, is why we kind of went to College Humor. And Sam and his position as, you know, an executive at College Humor, as head director, as head creative, he always knew, based on our background, what the idiosyncratic strengths of Josh Rubin were.
Yeah.
He'd always be like, I want to be your Lorne Michaels, or I know that you can do this weird, you know, because we'd smoke pot or make s'mores in Cape Cod and laugh about some obscure goblin voice that I do that we just kind of riff on. And so as he accumulated power, and climb the ranks of his job, he'd get more and more budget and go like, remember that thing that you did, or I know that you can do this weird thing, why don't you come do this weird thing in the context of this show or this thing. So he knew that I loved to make, you know, gun noises or whatever. There was an old series I did in College Humor called Josh's Mind House, where the whole thing was me shooting at like invisible robots and it's all sound effects. And he remembered that was fun, and then forayed that into like, take the British butler and have him just kind of take the revenge fantasy and blow it out into ridiculous portions. And it was the most fun ever because it was the last day of the production.
Oh,
so it was
the
wrap day, and it was just me and Sam just playing in a mansion and, you know, in Malibu and just having, it was the greatest. Then we'd like went out and got like Mexican food. That was a great day.
And also in that series that people can see on YouTube is Will Sasso, and he also is known for impressions and mimicry. Did the two of you have any sort of mimicry time?
We did a lot of De Niro, I remember that day. It was a lot of making each other laugh with different versions of, because he's a master mimic. So I remember giggling a lot about a lot about De Niro. But you know who was also there was Peter Serafinowicz was there and around. And Peter, we would just kind of like, I mean, we had a read through and I just said, can I please take a picture with you? I think you're just absolutely phenomenal. He's the best there ever is. Yeah. Was. So I think it was less sort of mimicking with him. I think I remember I attempted to do some Game of Thrones character and my voice completely faltered because I realized I was in the company of an Englishman.
Oh my gosh. And
a mimic.
Yeah.
But he and Will, yeah, that was fucking awesome.
Yeah, I would love just a show of just the three of you just talking about voices. Just because the people that have the ear for it, it's all the details, you know? It's all the little tiny, like when you do the breath or whatever. It's
that's what makes it great.
Yeah, it's endlessly funny. And it's funny to hear the different aspects, whether they pick a young Christopher Walken or an old Christopher Walken or whatever it is, you know? It's
testing 1, 2, testing 1, 2, 3, testing. Hello, this is Harry Stone. Today, I am a man.
He pops pills and begins recording what appears to be a suicide note because it's a great comedy. First interrupted by the door, then a call, and he keeps recording and keeps eating pills. It's in a staggering amount of pills he's eating.
And he's also fine. He like
he's great. Up no problem. He advises Francesca to find a man her age, but not a director.
You're not too old for me. I'm 22. You're 62.
It flashes back to a funeral because we need one more flashback. The people love the film. He turns the light on, scrapes the pills away. He's totally fine. Cut to the last scene of The Pickle where Molly's leaving with Isabella Rossellini. A cow cries and the pickle flies home. He makes it to the theater. There's one more pickle. He's inspired to make a movie about his life and childhood. He sees a flying pickle, Ally Sheedy and his childhood self.
Of course,
I'm not having a mental issue right now. This is the end of the film. And it's the end. That's it. We made it through The Pickle.
Imagine the money that the budget for that movie to shoot a pickle spaceship on the plaza with pickle juice hoses and crane shots and like
extras.
Shooting at the Paris Theater. And I mean, extras. And it's just so strange. But there was so much money for movies back. That was what you did.
Yeah, yeah.
You didn't look at your phone.
Yeah.
You know, you talked on your rotary and then walked to the Paris Theater or, I don't know, the Odeon and saw The Pickle. My God.
It's so crazy. Which brings us to the final part of the podcast. It's just some questions about yourself. Before we do that, do you have any final thoughts on Danny Aiello's starring piece in The Pickle?
He seems like a great guy.
Perfect. Very industry answer.
Yeah. He seems like a great guy. Danny Aiello, a great guy.
Are there any common misconceptions about directors?
Yes. I think I'd venture to guess one of the most common misconceptions is that they're all power-hungry control freaks. Mm. The unfortunate reality is that there's a lot of too collaborative noodles and pushovers. So you really do need to have, you realize you need to have a natural firm leadership quality and skill while also being super collaborative and empathetic. Ron Howard recently did these awesome DGA craft of directing interviews where he talks about like talking to actors and like get to understand their psychology before you get onto the set. One thing I did, I thought that was so interesting, is one thing I was nervous about, certainly with werewolves and also with Scare Me, with a lot of what I do, I'm chronically nervous about power struggles and making people feel uncomfortable, but also me feeling uncomfortable in the face of someone who might end up being a dickhead or not a great human being. Yeah. There's a lot of great human beings in our industry, but not a lot of great ones. So there's a lot of directors who can not take control and just sort of be plowed over. So I certainly didn't want to be plowed over. But one conversation I had with my actors in advance of Werewolves was how I'm so excited to go, you know, 3,000 miles away and I'm doing asshole checks. We're all going to be taken care of because I'm telling casting, you know, to do asshole checks, to check in, make sure that, hey, this person got a good reputation. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, I knew a lot of these guys are friends of friends. I, you know, when producers would bring up an actor who I heard, you know, was like a red state gun carrying, you know, temper tantrum-mer.
Yeah.
I was like, no, maybe we don't want to have someone who, you know, even if we hear that they're loosening up these days, yeah. Do we really need the risk?
Right.
It's, I'd say that, yeah, the common misconception is, you know, that they're all, you know, they're all a control freak, power trippers, I'd say.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that you're talking about sort of creating this community on the set, because it's all these people doing kind of the same jobs, like actors and whatnot, and then you're bringing them all together to make this cohesive piece, but also thinking about the cohesion of people on set is it's pretty awesome.
Oh, you have to. Yeah. You have to. You want people to feel comfortable. And I also think about what I would want as an actor. There's a few things I want. I want to be reminded who we are, where we're coming from.
Yeah.
And I don't want to feel stupid. Mm. So I want to feel supported, and I also want to be left alone. So I don't want you to micromanage me or give me line readings. I do that when it's comedy if I have to.
Right.
But typically, it's a lot of great casting. So if you can create the environment where people feel safe and let people validate people that what they're doing is funny or effective,
yeah,
that's crucial. That's what I want. And then if you, as the actor, you want me to do something differently, just tell me, you know,
right.
Shoot up a flare.
What is a good day like for you?
In general?
Directing.
A good day directing is when the props work, mm-hmm. When your actors are happy, when there's jovial vibes, you know, when we get everything done we needed to get done before lunch and there's not a post-lunch rush coupled with the post-lunch slump,
yeah.
Of being tired after eating, you know. the dopamine turkey. Is that dopamine turkey?
Tryptophan.
Tryptophan. Dopamine turkey would be a whole, that's a strange band.
Yes.
Tryptophan turkey. It's just when things, just whenever, you don't need to over communicate. Things are going well. You're prepared. For me personally, it's just prepared enough that I can get sleep the night before and not worried about some conflict or some fire to put out.
Oh yeah.
Where everyone's just going to be just happy, down to play, and that we're not rushing.
And what is a bad day like?
The opposite.
Yeah, it's a pretty obvious one.
That year, the scene is about a crucial prop. The prop shows up, and it's, you know, it's a giant pickle instead of a gun.
Right.
You say, well, remember we talked about the revolver with the ivory handle, and you brought me a pickle with a ribbon on it. Excuse me. to roll that into problems that actors are having, yeah. Like I'm so sensitive. So if an actor, you know, I had an actor tell me they didn't feel taken care of once.
Whoa.
And that was really, that hit me in the heart.
Yeah, that makes like, me hey. Uncomfortable.
Yeah, yeah. Like, hey, you know, we were moving too fast today and I felt like I didn't quite know what was going on. And I was like, oh, but it also, you have to have insulation,
right.
And empathy. You have to understand there's only so much sun in the sky. Your producers need this from you and that from you. The actors need it. You have to spread in only so many different directions. Not everybody's going to get everything they want, but ultimately you got to make your actors feel better than anything else, because that shit's going to live on forever.
Right.
And that's they can be cranky. They can feel, you know, butthurt, sensitive, you know, over emotional, under emotional. It's, you know, it's their performance is going to. It's gonna live on.
Yeah,
you know?
That's true. What is your favorite thing about being a director?
I do like the control. I do like the leadership position, but I also like roping in buddies. I love to create community. So
yeah.
If I can rope in buddies I've worked with before, I have an AD, Lenny Pan, who I've worked with on now it's 4 or 5 projects.
Yeah.
And we just get each other, and he's cool, understanding, never raises his voice, you know. for me to just say, hey, you bring on who you want to bring on for your departments, whoever you're comfortable with, for me to go to my acting buddies and bring them to the producers and say, look how great, you know, George Basil is. Yeah. Look how great Chris Redd is. Look how great Aya Cash is. Let me rope these guys in to a gig. And I think part of my, say what you will about how this sounds, but I think part of my initiative as a white dude in a position of power and leadership is to not always be creating communities where folks look like me.
Oh, yeah.
So if I can create a community that is not a bunch of white dudes and not a bunch of white people, if I'm able to bring in any marginalized person or persons, and also to say, to give them ownership to say, hey, bring on who you want for your department, who you feel comfortable, or do you have an idea for a stand-in for an actor? Does your cousin have a moving company in the area?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just like anything you can do in creating that community, you're just, it's possible. So it's also like, why not do it?
Yeah.
And also I don't really feel the need. I'm realizing as I get older, as someone who just wanted to be Jim Carrey or Robin Williams when he was a kid, that now it's like, I like the idea of sitting back and just sort of, you know, if I can levy or leverage my power to help other people find new talent, that'd be rad. That'd be a good day, a good career.
Yeah, that's, I love that. You already said your advice for someone who's interested in directing, and that's work your ass off at it.
Yeah, make some shit with your friends. Yeah.
Which brings me to the final question, and Josh, it's my favorite question.
Uh-oh.
Josh, what are your dreams like?
Usually I'm just, you know, I'm riding a big pink moth, but I really just want a job, you know? These days, a little anxiety ridden, but mostly cockeyed, which is great. You know, my dreams, if you're talking about literally the serotonin kind of dreams.
I'm going to say tryptophan again.
The tryptophanic dream. Ethereal.
When you're working on a specific project, do you have like stress directing dreams? Are you like, how are we going to make these werewolves work? Or...
there's a little bit of that. I love pressure. Mm. I love working on my toes. I think that's great. You know, when you asked me the five different types of pickles, I was like, oh my God, I'm so excited.
Yeah.
You know, some people don't love it. Some people have to be over-prepared for that type of shit. I think, you know, but anytime I'm stressed out has to do more with when someone I care about is stressed out. Mm. That's when I get stressed out, you know. If I care about you and you're stressed out and you're on my set or we're working together, then I'm like, oh, fuck. Then that tanks me.
Yeah. You sound sort of empathic in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. I was born the week of the empath for those of
well, there you go.
Astrological fans out there. My birthday is tomorrow and it's the week of the empath. Wow. It's a week of cancers. I think it's like June 22nd to July 1st or 4th or something. But yeah, I'm totally affected.
Yeah. That's interesting. That's probably part of why you, want to create this community of like-minded, sort of open-hearted, non-dick-headed people on your projects and things.
Yeah, yeah. I think it'll be a while before I become Michael Bay and just scream at everyone and, close myself off to the world to become an asshole. It won't happen. There's no other way to do it.
Yeah.
You know, we're not splitting the atom. You know, it's like... like, why the fuck not?
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Well, that's it. We did it. We did The Pickle. We talked
Hell
about
yeah.
Mazursky's masterpiece, one of a kind.
I'm so glad I scratched this in. You know, artisan ghost that's been haunting my mind. Like, hey, find out what that cover's all about.
Yeah. Well, I can't thank you enough for watching The Pickle. And then also... recording this episode. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you for sending it my way. I'll never dream this ending.
All right. Thank you.
All right, man. Thanks so much, Dirk.
Yeah. Take care.